I'm just delighted during this holiday season to welcome Neil to the Meaning Code. And Neil, you have something you want to talk about today, and I'd like you to introduce it to our burgeoning public out there.
Thanks, Karen. So I for a year I've been in the TLC and I've brought up evolutionary topics time and
Okay,
time
so for
again.
people who don't, I mean, my channel is, science, philosophy, faith, and a lot of people might have no idea what you mean when you say TLC. So start by at least what does the acronym stand for?
This little corner of the internet, it's a community of people who are aware of each other's participation and meandering, let's put it that way. All around topics downstream of Jordan Peterson, downstream of Paul Vanderclay, John
Okay.
Vervaeke,
Okay,
Jonathan
great.
Pageau.
Okay. Now, proceed.
So a particular topic that I wanted to talk to other people about is the application of evolutionary ideas to human social phenomena. So not human evolution per se, but the evolution of human social organizations. And everything from corporations to even churches, which is obviously gonna trigger some folks, to basically the changing times that we live in now. I see evolutionary principles at work. And it's difficult for me to deny those principles when I see them at work. Things like speciation, like brand new social forms emerging. But specifically, the reason why I wanted to talk to you is because one of the things I've learned from you, I think it's the most, probably the most important thing I've learned from you, are the eight principles of design. You also talk about the seven elements of design, but the eight principles, and I'll list them out here. So unity, harmony, contrast, dominance, repetition, gradation, variation, and balance. And what has frustrated me with the overall scientific community, let's say, is that the overall consensus of the scientific community at present are that things like art or things like beauty or things like principles of design are, let's say, emergent but meaningless in and of themselves, that they are offshoots, like from an evolutionary standpoint. And this is a book that I'm mildly obsessed with, although I disagree with the author on a number of things, the evolutionary beauty. He's
Richard,
a,
okay,
yeah,
Richard
Rich,
Froom.
Rich, Richard Prume. He's an evolutionary ornithologist, and I disagree with him on a number of things. However, his overall premise is that beauty happens, and beauty in nature, and beauty is a, how should I say, a separate evolutionary driver than simply fittedness to the natural environment. But where I differ from Dr. Prume is the arbitrary, like I think he would say that I am projecting some human meaning into the phenomena of beauty in nature. Like I'm projecting my human value system. And so he can only say scientifically that beauty happens and it's arbitrary. But I instead, what I see, the more I understand evolutionary forces, is that there's a push force, which is, let's call it, the drive away from vulnerability in nature. And the push force, the drive away from vulnerability, is what is typically or conventionally considered natural selection, let's say. But I would, instead of natural selection, because all everything of what I'm going to talk about, I really think could be fit into the natural selection category. But I would call it fittedness to the survival, fittedness to the environment. That's what I would call it. That's the first force. But then there's a secondary force that's more of a pull force, which you could describe as our instinct for quality, our instinct for beauty, our instinct for the ideal, whatever the ideal is. And from Prume's perspective, and even Prume is controversial in this. Like most evolutionary biologists still believe, nope, it's natural selection all the way down. And that, let's say, from a sexual selection perspective, that anything beautiful is just signaling physical fitness, and the same applies to all of nature. And I think that's fundamentally, I disagree with that completely. And I'll give some examples. It's short-sighted. It doesn't explain the forms that are seen in nature. And what I think is happening is opponent processing all the way down in nature, across the board. So I'm talking the two hemispheres of our brain, I think, have evolved to adapt to these two separate evolutionary forces. I think our left hemisphere has evolved to reduce vulnerability, and I think our right hemisphere has evolved to, I don't even know how to describe it. I'll call it desire or an instinct for quality. I don't know how to describe that second force. Hold on one second. I'm gonna just open my blinds here if we get some more light. And so I see that in the left hemisphere, right hemisphere mapping, which goes, as far as I understand it, that any organism with a cerebral cortex has that dual hemispheric structure. And I see so many processes right now where beauty as an independent force has sort of run away or has become disembodied. So an example of that is like video game addiction for boys. So they're chasing the beauty instinct or whatever. It's the same instinct because it's the instinct to something amazing and incredible and high quality, but it's completely detached from any physicality, from any real consequence, let's say. And the same thing happens kind of in the social media space, like searching for likes and attention and love and adulation. So in nature, you get these runaway forms, these runaway, like the peacock is the classic example, but there's countless examples of this. And what's so interesting about it is that it's not just beauty, or not beauty in the conventional sense. And that's why I'm hesitant to call it the driver beauty, because have you ever seen like some of these underwater fish, for instance, where they have like giant, absolutely giant like teeth and dead eyes, and they're just these horrifying specimens. There's this spider called, I don't even know how to pronounce it. It's called the ambipyle spider. It's like a scorpion combined with a spider, and it's the most horrifying thing that you've ever seen. And but it's real,
Or
like
is
it
that
exists.
just our bias? Maybe according to the scientists, you might think of it as beautiful.
Well, so is it our bias
I'm just yanking your chain.
no? I mean, no, that really is the criticism is like, so why would humans have, let's say, horror art as art, right? Like Hieronymus Bosch. But the thing is, like, so we have Hieronymus Bosch and we have Halloween, we have these rituals of, let's say, where the horror is gives us an opportunity to stare at it in order to mitigate the psychological effect upon us. But that horror is still reflective in the broader natural reality. Like we have this archetypal idea of dragons in our minds, and sure enough, we discover dinosaurs. And the really the only thing that prevented dinosaurs from becoming dragons is you have gravity, you have weight, and you have physical instantiation that prevents. So it's the dual tug and pull, you know, push and pull of, well, it's not going to get any bigger because there are physical constraints that an organism gets any bigger than that, and blood flow and all sorts of, you know. And so like all of the span of human art, ranging from Tim Burton, Hieronymus Bosch, to, you know, the most beautiful, like K-pop, like the most beautiful, idolized, everything's perfect in perfect harmony. The musical where everyone's singing and dancing at the end of the musical, or Titanic where everyone's lined up at the end of the movie and celebrating the marriage of the feminine and the masculine come together, and everyone's in that liturgical procession. Like all of that is in line with nature. You know, we have all those forms of art in nature in a lesser degree. And so the question is like, okay, are we just projecting our own psyche and seeing these in nature, or are we reflective of a deeper reality, and that deeper reality has the opportunity to be made manifest through human consciousness, through our exploration. That we're just and okay, here's another reason why I think there are twin forces. Because the overall obsession, let's say, with the left brain world as it now is, as I see it, that atheist impulse for, well, we just need to fix everything. We just need to solve problems. We just need to, and it's this, like, if you dig into the classical atheist position, what the highest good is something like the reduction of suffering. And it, there's and they'll say things like, oh, art is good and this, but there's no evidence other than like a feeling or an instinct that the art is good, that this is good. And because it makes people feel good, and then you kind of devolve into postmodern, that's just your opinion, man, type semantics. But as I see it, that atheist position is left brain centric, and everything, the entire way that we've been looking at evolution by natural selection since Darwin. Well, actually, Darwin believed in sexual selection, but post it was Wallace who kind of took it and said, nope, it's natural selection all the way down. It's vulnerability all the way down. And it's turtles all the way down. But anyway, ever since that, it's been a tremendously left brain view of evolution. And scientists have tried to explain all the diverse forms in nature, have said, oh, it's symmetry, and symmetry is beauty, and symmetry is a measure of physical fitness, and that's been kaput. Like that thesis is dead. It hasn't been able to be replicated. And the way I see it is the vulnerability is the uniting force that brings us all together, because we're all instantiated in this realm. And the multiplicity is the force that, because there are so many ways, and this is where I think it might get into your eight principles of design. This is really why I wanted to talk to you about this, because there are so many ways that something can be beautiful or remarkable, or and so like the Hieronymus Bosch example is a great example, because it's not beautiful at all in the classical sense, and yet it captures you. It pulls you to something that's beyond your current conception to imagine. And yet all of these forms are still reflected in nature. So that's I just laid out a ton. It was all over the place, but it's the first time I've gotten to vomit all of it. So I apologize.
It's okay. I'm gonna start digging a little bit, and then I have some thoughts. Do you believe that the fact that we have two hemispheres necessitates evolution? I mean, you use the framing that we evolved the two hemispheres.
I think it's yes.
Well, do you think that because we see it in lower forms, is that the reason you think it necessitates evolution?
Well, here's a question. And I believe there's actually math demonstrating why this is, but why don't we have three sexes instead of two? Why don't any species have three sexes or four sexes or five? Wouldn't that cause more random mutation at a faster rate? And I think it has something to do with opponent processing.
Well,
I think
that's not the purpose for my question. Okay,
sure.
I noticed early on when I started listening to Jordan Peterson's biblical lectures, he's going on and on about how this evolved and that evolved, and because this evolved, that other thing happened, and he's going through this whole thing of evolution and making a very tight case for evolution. And I'm thinking, wow, he's also making a very tight case for creation. Because all the things he's saying are also things that can be used as data points to support creation. And it's simply in how you interpret those data points that you come down on one side or the other. Now, I have no problem whatever with microevolution, evolution that goes on within a species, or even what is termed speciation nowadays is actually just talking about maybe something akin to hybridization, or two things coming together and creating something that's new. But these are not new species in the sense of what we were taught, like 100 years ago, what a species was very cut and dried, had specific parameters, and they couldn't cross borders without the offspring becoming sterile. That's no longer the definition of species. But if you keep that as your definition of species, we haven't jump-started new species within recorded history, at least, as far as I know.
I think there's
There's a lot of new
I
species of birds and
yeah.
dogs and things like that, but they can all breed with each other and they can all have offspring that are not sterile.
I think there is evidence of new species in the scientific literature, but I couldn't tell you what they are off the top of my head.
Well,
You know,
maybe some
COVID,
people will jump into the comments and let us know.
COVID is one that affected all of us. You know, I mean, you could, I believe is most likely human created. I'm sorry to, throw that in there, but yeah, I mean, that was an example of something novel. Yeah, but you could say so, but I'll give you examples in human social realms where something like
But that's a novel virus. And as far as I know, scientists are still arguing about whether viruses are alive in the same sense, because it's not, it's only half of the DNA that's functioning in. I mean, a virus is more like a parasite in that it has to attach to something that has DNA in order to replicate itself. Is that not correct?
Yeah, I think that might be right in regard to into viruses, but I think there's evidence of, I remember seeing a study of a certain type of I think it was a lizard that was changing in real time due to pollution in that environment. And I saw another one that was in relation to Chernobyl, that animals around Chernobyl were changing at a faster rate. But they were still mixing in with the general population. So, to your point, I can't say like it's this species over
Oh, I
here.
mean, we see lots and lots of mutation for sure, and when they do all the experiments with the birds or insects that change color when they're in a polluted environment, because then they blend in better with the smoke and all of that kind of stuff. But usually, if they're moved back into a non-polluted environment over a few generations, they'll go back to their original. This is one of the things that Michael Levin has discovered. And I mean, he's evolution all the way down. And yet, there what he's discovered, he thinks that the track for evolution is not tracking characteristics, but tracking adaptability, the intelligence to adapt and make changes when those changes are required. Even if those changes are quite extreme. And he's done a lot. He always looks at everything that through the lens of how can I build an experiment to verify whether or not this idea is correct. So he doesn't go off on the evolutionary tr thought train of, well, maybe it happened this way, or maybe it happened that way, or well, how can we imagine that this might have happened? He goes down the train of what experiments can I do to verify certain things? And so he set up a lot of experiments to verify one way and another. And one of the things that he came up with was that I'm sure you've heard the stuff about his xenobots, where he took frog skin cells, scraped them off into some sort of a medium, and those skin cells actually bonded with each other and created a new entity that was capable of motility, moving around in the medium, and capable of gathering up other skin cells into little new entities and making their own little community in order to survive. And he said that happened within less than 48 hours. So if you dropped those entities into a river someplace and they were found by somebody else, let's imagine that they could exist for a long time and they're found by somebody else 1,000 years later, pull them out, they're going to have the same DNA as a frog, but they're a completely different entity. So I think it's perfectly possible that those kinds of things are happening. And like I said, Peterson makes a very tight case for evolution, but I also think there's just as tight a case for the fact that we have two hemispheres is a very beautiful design and very purposeful and accomplishes many things other than just scientifically necessary things for us as human beings, and leads to a lot of these things in the arena of social phenomena and everything that you're talking about. So anyway, there's that. I don't know if we want to talk about that yet, or if we want to go over to some of these other things. You were talking about The Evolution of Beauty by Richard Prum, and I think it's interesting that he's looking at birds, because the guy I really like is a guy by the name of Stephen Talbot, who has written a book. What is Stephen Talbot's book? He has gone through and looked at all sorts of creatures and tells their stories, and they all have very interesting stories. And in those stories, you see that there are things that simply cannot be explained by an evolutionary paradigm. And he's not even against evolution. He's probably been an evolutionist himself, but he's just saying, here are all these questions that we don't even know how to approach looking at. You mentioned the beauty of birds. You can think of the bowerbird, that has learned to design these beautiful nests to attract the female. And you stop and really think about the bowerbird, you try to imagine how that might have evolved. It's kind of crazy. And another bird he talks, well, he just talks about a regular kind of a bird that there aren't that many birds that mate for life. And whatever this particular kind of bird is, it's one that mates for life. And so this particular kind of a bird, I can't remember what it is, he goes into a neighborhood, and he's got to find a neighborhood that's going to be a good environment for him to raise a family. And he finds a neighborhood that works for that. He spends several weeks in that neighborhood, going around the neighborhood and singing and marking out that neighborhood from all his enemies. This is going to be my territory, and you stay out of here. And once he's got the whole territory marked, then he has to go and find a mate. And then he brings that mate into that territory, and then he builds a nest with her, which is a very complicated maneuver, making exactly the right kind of nest and getting the sticks in exactly the right place so that they support this little burgeoning family. He goes through all the things that this bird does in order to prepare for these eggs that come along. And then, the female sits on the nest and he guards away from all the predators this whole time that this is happening. This would be your push force, your drive away from vulnerability, right? Okay, take that push force all the way back to the beginning, when you have the origin of life, which some people are trying to say was a drop of oil that fell into a certain environment, and because it got some, lipid shell around it, then it started with inside the drop of oil, it started to develop into something approaching a cell, and then found a way to proliferate. Why is it proliferating? Because proliferating must be better than not proliferating.
Yeah, it
So
needs a pull force.
value has to precede any action towards life. And that value has to be life is better than not life. And for something that has never experienced life, where on earth does that come from, that life is better than not life? I mean, these are questions that I ask myself. And I think about Carl Friston's argument that that within every organism, there has to be a map, an internal map of the external environment so that it can navigate the external environment. How do you take that all the way down to the beginning and the origin of life? How does this original, whatever this thing is in the beginning, how does that have an internal map of the external environment? So if you are going to argue for evolution, you still have to find the precursor that provides the will to live and the internal map and the value system for whatever this new life is going to be. If God, if you have an entity capable of that, then what is the problem with just simply creating man and woman the way that it states in the Bible? I mean, the
He
one is,
could.
one is no harder than the other.
But I think there's a question even beyond that, which is if you're perfect and omnipotent and omniscient, why create anything at all? Especially why create anything outside of yourself that's imperfect or incomplete? Or and I think the answer is God's voluntary vulnerability. The one thing an omniscient and omnipotent thing does not have is vulnerability. A parent or an adult who has everything and, has everything, but then suddenly they have a child that they cannot control, they cannot govern, and has a mind of his or her own. And so the parent feels vulnerability on behalf of the thing that they don't have control over, the person. And I think it's something like that. It's God creates a frame of vulnerability. It's th this answer, the evolution thing, is like one thing I've contemplated is like, how could God be the most humble and omniscient and omnipotent being? And it's something like with the weakest possible form, with the least sufficient possible form, watch them grow. Watch how they move towards me, or and that's so like the evolutionary story doesn't bother me because I see what God does in 9 months. If he could do a lot in 4 billion years, 3 billion, I'm not disputing it's a miracle. Like, I'm not disputing that.
Sure.
What
But I
I'm
mean,
trying to
so basically then you buy the whole 4 billion years thing.
I don't think it matters whether how do I say this? I put the creation story at Genesis at a higher level of value, regardless of the physicality of the creation story of Genesis. I put that at a higher level of value than the evolution story because it's more valid to our experience. It's actually more useful. But what I see happening now is social forms, speciation. I'll give you four examples of speciation that have occurred in the last 10 years, 15 years. The Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street, Me Too, Black Lives Matter. Those are just four that popped in my head. A day prior or a week prior, that social species did not exist. And then suddenly it's everywhere, whatever it is. It is certain people are part of that species. For everyone else, they're still fixed on it. It's like, oh, this is a new thing. And so I see, so my thesis there, and I already shared this in an episode I put out recently, but my thesis there is that you have a common locus of attention, whatever that common attention is of a given body. So let's say it's rock and roll of the 60s, common locus of attention, rock and roll. And we're gonna usher in the era of peace, love, and happiness. But inevitably, there are people on the outskirts of that body that are more vulnerable and they have less to lose and they have the creative impulse and they're mutating like crazy. And then a recession hits in 73 to 75. And then at 77, you get the Sex Pistols. Say, we are a different species. We are not our parents' generation of the 60s. You get Black Sabbath and metal. So you get all this mutation. You get Pink Floyd. psychedelic rock. You get all this mutation because all this human attention is focused on rock and roll in the 60s. The body gets bigger and bigger and bigger. The psychotechnology that's binding that body together also needs to scale in relation to the size of that body in order to bind it all together in one. I'm calling it a species because the question is, do the members of that form, are they bound around a different locus of attention or the same? And for something like punk rock and the Sex Pistols, it's so obviously different because they're an absolute rebellion from their previous form. It's like, no, we're bound around this. Like, you have long hair, we're making short hair. You have and but you see other species emerge from the edges of the former rock and roll form. You see, like I mentioned, Pink Floyd or metal. Anyway, like we are living in a time of tremendous mutation of social forms right now. Like I think it's happening faster right now than ever before because we're trying to find the fittedness between the vulnerability and whatever is pulling us. Like the nihilism. So I'll give an example. Going back all the way to 1880s, you get postmodern art starting in the late 1800s, I think because of the rise of photography. It's kind of a recognition that, like, when we're going for, well, you know a lot more about art than I do, so let me know what you think about this. So I see more and more, I see art moving towards a more and more realistic ideal up until the rise of photography. So art in the early 1800s, like incredibly beautiful, precise, ideal work. And then the late 1800s, now you're getting into dreams and abstraction and you're moving on. Because art has to mutate in order to stay relevant compared to as photography gets better and better and better and better, because of course it can't aim for realism anymore. So, and then the same trend happens in music. The same trend happens in architecture. The same trend happens. Like we can't get any better than the beautiful architecture of, let's say, a certain era. And every time that happens, the attention locus jumps in people. So like art is not as prominent in people's minds by the time of movies as it was in the 1880s, let's say. But once you get movies, you get a different art form. But then there's this trend towards, to me, it seems like the trend goes toward Gnosticism, meaning we're going to have just beauty devoid of all purpose. So the way Pajot talks about, you got to marry the purpose with art or beauty, whatever purpose of binding that's serving. You get sort of the Gnostic impulse in art because it's trying to do art for art's sake, like Oscar Wilde, art for art's sake. And then once that happens, it inevitably, like that's basically an evolutionary beauty force spiraling, and then, but there's no physicality to it, and so it just becomes nominalism. It becomes everything is just meaningless. It's not tied to the other force, and so then what happens is people, it drops into nihilism. People jump forms. They jump art forms because we have such an impulse for that beauty instinct, or you can call it whatever you want, whatever. So for boys, it became video games. But I see this cycle repeating kind of over and over throughout. As technology has increased, the same cycle has repeated across technological forms. And whatever art is captivating our attention the most, typically it's doing that because of beauty, because, yeah, anyway, it's a
Well, I'd
lot.
like to draw a different picture for you.
Sure.
Not based on any, this isn't based on any knowledge that I have of art or anything, but just as you were talking, a different picture just fell into my mind. that the drive towards more and more realistic representational art in the 1800s, I feel like was a response to the whole move of modernism, because if you go back to the iconographic art of the 13th, 14th centuries, it was quite flat. It didn't have a lot of form to it. It was quite flat, so that the figure and the ground played with each other, which left a lot of room for interpretation. So it didn't require a sharp focus, could kind of allow your mind to play with the images and play with the story. And then as you're moving into more and more realistic, more form-oriented, that's a response to the modernism, to the science and everything, to become more and more representational. How representational can we become? That's actually moving into modernism. And I kind of look at, I mean, all of a sudden, I think, I don't know if this is true, but what my mind is telling me is that when we move into the impressionistic era, that was a response partly to the photography issue. And because we're already in the world of modernism at that point, there is a hunger for novelty, because once you get separated from the source, everything has to be moving towards novelty. But also, there was this is about in the era of the Romantic poets. And so there's more of this move towards how can these artworks represent this more romantic world? Because the early Impressionists were really these beautiful, evocative colors and shapes but then of course you move into the Blue Rider and the crazy moving into the crazy colors, and you get into Van Gogh and some of the people after him, and then it becomes more and more abstract, which is moving more and more into this modernist frame, abstracting away from meaning and purpose into this abstract world, until you kind of swing back into abstract expressionism, which is all about letting your heart get out there on the canvas, even if it doesn't represent anything at all. What that seems to me is it represents more like something, this addiction to novelty. You know how in addiction, when you're addicted to something and you get a certain level of, you get a hit, you get this dopamine hit whenever you get the thing, but then at a certain point, the dopamine hits aren't coming hard and fast anymore because you've developed a resistance to it. So you have to find more and more novelty to get more and more hits from this thing. So it's this addiction to novelty that's happened in the 20th and 21st century is getting faster and faster and faster, which leads us into, and the same thing happened in the music scene. The addiction to novelty means that the musical forms change so fast that nowadays the only thing that can be different is to go back to the old stuff and have all the retro, right? So to me, it's more of a picture of moving from connection to a foundation and purpose and meaning, which was all upward, into this progressive move where as Wolfgang Smith said, it's like the escalator all of a sudden fell over and now is just a train track moving relentlessly forward, and we don't even know forward into what. But as long as you get more novelty and as long as you're moving forward, you think you're getting someplace. To me, it's more of that picture than it is. And really, that's the picture of evolution. Evolution is supposedly moving forward to something that supposedly, is it better? I mean, do the evolutionists claim that what we're moving towards is better? Because if they claim that, then you're right back into a value system. You can't get away from a value system.
Yeah, well, I think what so there's runaway beauty in evolution, runaway novelty, whatever you want to call it. So the novelty problem, I completely agree with everything you just said about we get addicted to the novelty, but it still does nothing to explain why something is novel to us, why something captures our attention, why we're attracted to something. So like the peacock example, if the peacock had serious predators that could actually hunt it due to its limitations in its ecosystem, the peacock would die out. So what I see happening in nature is that beauty goes to the maximum extent it can, which is where it's still reproductively successful, where it's still able to continue on into the next generation. It has to reach a reproductive equilibrium, whatever that is. And so if a form gets too ridiculous, so dogs have this problem. You probably know more about dogs than I do in this regard, but you breed dogs in a certain way to the point where they can't see well, they can't do this well, da, 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 because we have taken a hold of dog, reproduction and evolution to suit our own inclinations. I want the toughest, meanest, toughest, strongest dog there is. I want the cutest, smallest, da, 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 dog there is. And it's an emulation of our own psychic form, you could say, our own psychic differentiation and individuation reflected in man's best friend. But I see the point is that there still has to be that pull towards whatever we find attractive, beautiful. And what I'm saying, that pull is, I'm not saying that that pull is all good. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying that that pull is also, so an example of, like, let's say a person, I was thinking about this a couple days ago, a person who's only governed by the one evolutionary principle, let's say the vulnerability principle, that would be Scrooge in A Christmas Carol. I was reading Christmas Carol for a Bible study I'm in, and I was like, oh yeah, that's what happens when you only think about the pragmatic side of life. Like, I'm gonna store up all my stuff in barns, and if I have too much stuff, I'm gonna tear down the barns and I'm gonna build new ones, and I'm gonna store up, and survival of the fittest, right? But another example. So here's another example of the twin. So, Beauty and the Beast, Belle can choose Gaston or this random outsider, stranger, crazy beast thing, and so Gaston. He's really good at reducing vulnerability, right? He can hunt, he can kill, he can provide. He's at the top of the male social hierarchy. He's got everything a gal wants. And there's something missing from Gaston, you know? There's still something missing. It's the entire other half of the picture. And you could say, well, maybe Belle just knows that she'll be deeply unhappy because he's this, misogynist machismo BS, and that might be true. But you still have to explain the thing that is pulling in the other direction. You still have to explain that. And what I'm saying is that thing that's pulling in the other direction, I think that's more distinctive to reality than yeah, I don't know what to say other than, like, the things that we seem to value, the things that we seem to desire, they seem also across all of nature. So that implies to me, and across culture, across, so that implies to me that, like, no, this is woven into the very fabric of existence. And your point about
Well,
that,
I mean,
oh,
okay,
go ahead.
let's take that. Opponent processing is woven into the very fabric of existence. I totally agree with that. I think that's at the very beginning of everything. I mean, not at the beginning beginning, because the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit were not in opposition to one another. But oh. My brain is exploding with 14 ideas at once, and I don't know where to go with it. But opponent processing is very important in this whole idea of the principles of art, the elements and principles of art, because every choice that you make is a choice between one thing and another. Well, every choice that you make is coming out of. If you could think of, let's say that the two hemispheres are focus and exploration. It's another way of looking at it. You say the push towards vulnerability and the pull towards the ideal, or the push is the drive away from vulnerability. Okay.
Yes.
And I'm not sure how I feel about that. But I do understand the other side being the being pulled towards the ideal, because I think that is also one of the very fundamental things that has to do with how the world arose. In fact, I just wrote something in my journal this morning that maybe I'll read later regarding that. But if you think about art, if you think about the elements and principles of art, every time an artist has to make a stroke, it's as though they're facing the unknown, which Peterson calls chaos. Basically, you're facing the sea of chaos. It's like the spirit of God hovering over the waters. It's like that, because once you, if you calculate how many choices are available to an artist with every stroke of paint, completely incalculable. I mean, it's computationally irreducible number of choices that you have to make. So somehow you have to build parameters. You have to find some way forward. So you set yourself some limitations, and then you set yourself a goal, and all of those things narrow your focus enough so that you can focus enough to make a choice. And the choice that you make, thankfully, is not the last choice, because every subsequent choice gets to go and marry itself to that previous choice. And every time one of those marriages takes place, it sort of shows you where the next step is. So you're always, it's always this opponent processing that's happening between one choice and another choice. And let's say your choice has to do with how dark or light in the value scheme should this mark be. That dark and light is on a spectrum, all the way from very dark to very light. So you have to choose where along that spectrum. And it's not like 10 steps, it's like a million gajillion steps along that spectrum that you could choose from. And then you have to choose, okay, if it's dark and light, but it's going to be an orange color, is it going to be brilliant or is it going to be subdued? What kind of orange is it going to be? And is it an orange that's made with red and yellow, or is it going to be an orange that's made with gold and purple? You know, what is it going to be made of, and why? Why does it have to be that choice? And every single choice comes with all these questions that are in your head. It's opponent processing all the way between the idea that's in my head and the actions that I take to instantiate that idea. And this is what it comes into, why I say, like, one side of the two hemispheres is the focus, like the bird able to focus on the grain of wheat that's in amongst the gravel. But the other side of the bird is the exploration that's open to not just the dangers that are out there, but also the beauties that are out there and all the possibilities that are there for that bird. So the bird consists of both of those sides every time a bird is involved in anything. And that is, it's like our right and left hand. You know, if you happen to be a right-handed person, that connects up with your left hemisphere. So your right hand is good at gripping, it's good at using tools, it's good at maneuvering things. But the left hand is the exploratory side. So for artists, sometimes an artist will have, say, maybe they recently, I broke my left hand. Thankfully, it wasn't my right hand. So, you know, I can still use my right hand and get things done. My left hand is, it's getting better, but it's still very, very weak. So I can't do anything with it. But let's say it was my right hand that got broken. My left hand would be able to work. So if I paint with my left hand, it's going to be very much more expressive and innovative and much more novel shapes and exploratory looking work than if I paint with my right hand, because my right hand can get very specific and very representational and get very tight and make all these perfect little designs and everything. But my left hand has to work in more broad strokes, and I don't have as much control over it. So what happens is much more creative in many ways when you use your non-dominant hand. And I think that is what is always happening in the world, is that the right hemisphere is this exploratory, looking at novelty in a different way. And I think maybe one of the things that we have to figure out is why, with the rise of the scientific world and the move away from the foundations and everything, all of the things that McGilchrist blames on the left hemisphere that are happening coming into the modern world, and yet there is some sort of a drive for novelty that's just unspooling all the time, making faster and faster all these groups. When you mentioned all those Occupy Wall Street and all these political movements that arise and fall, I wonder though how much of that is attached to the news media and how the news media can get the word out very fast within its own network of not conspirators, but people that are working together towards a certain goal. They can get the word out. This is the thing we're going to focus on. We're either going to be for this thing or against this thing.
I think it's way more bottom up versus top down conspiratory. I think it's way more bottom up. And the reason is because, like, right before the Civil War, you had a proliferation of like thousands of newspapers in the 40 years before the Civil War. You went from, and I did some research on this. You had like 200 newspapers turn of the 1800s. It went up to like 10 times that number by 1840, 1850. And newspapers were ubiquitous, penny paper, everyone was reading. And I think that had a tremendous amount to do with the rise of the abolition movement leading to the Civil War. And the same thing, I think, goes for the democracy, because from the 50s, we had a news monoculture from about 50s to the 80s. We had the big three, ABC, CBS, NBC, and then 80s comes and you get CNN, Fox News. But then the 90s comes, the internet starts, you get alternative media, and then 2010s, you get social media. So it's the democratization of all mutation in media forms. And I think that is what has, absolutely.
But what I'm talking about is more like you have all of the old media, all of the newspapers and the old TV stations and everything, the what some people call the mainstream media. They're more like a monoculture today. I mean, they're just one thing. They're like one head, because whatever they decide is the thing, they're all going to say the same thing. They're going to say use the same language, the same terminology. They're going to make the same attacks or the same praises.
Yes,
But then you have all the social media, which is this proliferation of thought and ideas on the other side of that.
but I see the polarity has changed in the last 20 years, where before 20 years ago it was the media driving the conversation, and now it's the conversation driving what the media reports on. You're right that they still have to see it through a monoculture lens, but it's way beyond. Chad talked about how he was seeing a subtle shift in the YouTube personalities, like the gamer personalities and others that he was seeing between 2020 and 2024, where it was just a subtle shift where, okay, maybe Trump isn't the devil. And it was just like, and Chad was seeing that because Chad is a quality detector. But whatever that right brain is, that's what Chad's a master at that. My wife is too, but like I've noticed certain people who are like I'm actually naturally much more left brain centric. It was my religious conversion that opened up my right brain. But so these patterns were already moving under the surface, is my point. They're already there. And it's our media moved from being proactive generators to how should we craft this narrative to now they're reactive receivers. And that's a big shift that I see. But
Well,
right
yeah, I mean,
now,
that all started happening when they lost control of the narrative, and the only place they could get news stories was by reading Twitter. I mean, I noticed that like 5 or 10 years ago, all the news stories are so and so said something on Twitter. Well, how is that a news story in the big newspapers? You know, that's just ridiculous. Go out and find your own news. But I can see that. But
But I'd like to go back real quick to
yeah, we
you
sort of
were,
got
no. So as you were talking about the, as you were painting, you're talking about painting with the left hand versus the right hand. It made me think. So I've asked this question to other people in the corner. I posed it as an estuary topic. I said, is music invented or discovered? Or is art invented or discovered? And because I look at someone else brought in an example to my attention. But we always hear about Mozart just kind of transcribing the music. Like he didn't go back and edit. He was just writing down what he already, and I think he was just receiving. I think some people, their right brain is set up to receive the music, to receive the art. Oscar Wilde is the second example where I learned that he wrote and had very few edits, like almost nothing. He just wrote the whole novel. And it's like, how does that work? And I think that we are receivers, that our right brain is receiving something. Like how does inspiration happen? How does creativity? And Peterson talks about that all the time. And that to me speaks of that overarching unified force that's sort of pulling us into that final telos. So
Well,
yeah, I
let
mean,
me just say something about that because that fits perfectly with both McGilchrist's proposition and Esther Meek with the covenantal knowing. And that is that this idea that whenever we are confronting the unknown, which is really every moment of future history, it is really the unknown that is reaching back to us with a gift of knowing. Because, I mean, really, when you think about it, when you think about the unknown, there's uncountable number of unknown things. So why is it that I begin to know one thing and not another thing? It's because that thing is reaching out to me with love. Here is a gift of knowing for you. And if you build a relationship with that gift of knowing that's being offered to you, then that can become a part of you and you can learn more from that gift of knowing. One of the examples that Esther Meek and Michael Polanyi and people like that that she was learning from talk about is this idea that when you learn to ride a bicycle, you're building a relationship with the bicycle in the way that the learning and the knowing of the bicycle become integrated into your being. Okay, so you develop not only muscle memory, but you actually develop kind of a love relationship with the process, and so you de develop a love relationship with the bicycle. And she would say it's really impossible to know anything if you're not developing a loving relationship. Another example that she uses that I've talked about before is, you have a rose bush, you want to take good care of your rose bush because you want it to be beautiful, but you have to learn to love the rose bush enough to want to take care of it. And when you do that, then you'll begin to observe and focus on the rose bush. What does it need? You know, does it need trimming? Does it need food? And that's all about knowing in the biblical sense. You know, in the Old Testament, it talks about knowing. It's a very intimate term. So that's what knowledge is, and it's always reaching out to you as a gift. So yes, it's always pulling us towards, and like, and I've just got to read this thing I wrote this morning, and this is rough draft, okay? I haven't edited it at all, but you know the story of there's this passage, I think it's in Matthew 17, maybe verse 20, where Jesus is talking about the mustard seed. And he's upbraiding the disciples a little bit. He's saying, this happened because you have little faith. But I tell you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, that you will say to this mountain, be moved into the midst of the sea, and it will be moved. I used to think that he was saying, even if your faith is only as big as a mustard seed. But that's not what he's saying. Basically, the word that's used there is a comparative word. If you have faith like a mustard seed. So it has nothing to do with the size of the mustard seed. So I started to think, well, what is it about a seed that would be connected to this idea of faith? And then I wrote this. On the one hand, yes, a mustard seed is small. And even a small faith can work miracles because it's not the size of the faith, but it's the size of the one in whom we have faith, right? But something else is happening too, for the Greek comparative word does not refer to the size of the seed, but rather says to have faith like the seed. It seems perfectly plausible to me that every part of his creation operates on faith, or rather, the better translation of that word faith is trust. Operates on trust that God is good. A seed knows that it can be separated from its mother plant and still trust that God is good. Even when it falls to the earth and is buried in the damp ground, it still trusts. Even when it rests in the cold, dark place through a long, torturous winter, still it can believe that God is good and has a plan. And when the sun warms the earth and life stirs within, it joyously sends forth its roots and shoots to burst upward into the sunshine. God is always calling his creation to himself through the darkness, through the cold, through the isolation, and the final state will be glorious. And I think it's that way with cells. I think it's that way with seeds. Being drawn towards the ideal is the only way that growth happens. And when you think about seeds and trees growing and cells that are not given any sort of a plan through their DNA about what they're supposed to do, and yet somehow when the cells grow to a certain number, they're able to communicate with each other about who is going to do what and how it's going to get done. And this whole process is much more intensive than building a city. And yet all of this happens within 9 months, and everybody has their job and they're all being pulled towards the ideal, and they know how far to go and when to stop and where to be and how to work together and how to get out of each other's way when somebody else has to come in and move something around. And inside of each cell, this is also happening at another level of an entire city being built inside of the cell. And everything inside the cell seems to know how to get out of the way of everything else when materials being transported through tubules. And, you know, I just don't, the more that I look at all this stuff, I don't buy that this all evolved by accident. And yeah, certainly natural selection is insufficient to describe it. And I'm beginning to agree with the people that say, if we accept evolution, then we have to also accept that all this death and suffering and torment happened before the fall. And indeed, what is the fall if evolution happened?
Well, even if believe,
evolution is the whole answer. I mean, if macroevolution is the whole answer, not just microevolution.
I've got about four things that I want to go into based on everything you just covered. One is that can you pick the first time you were conscious, Karen Wong, the first time in your life that you were conscious?
No, of course not.
I have no idea. And yet I have no doubt that at some point, from my single cell beginning to my existence now, that I crossed some threshold, some boundary, some...
Levin is always talking about that too. Yeah.
Yeah, but I suspect
there's no actual line.
Yeah, exactly. It's, and so that like first Adam or first Eve or that first conscious, that doesn't really bother me because again, I can go all the way back. I can just go to my own existence, and it doesn't really matter to me if God unfolds all of this in 7 days or unfolds it in 4 billion years. I'm just trying to understand the patterns in the world as best I can with the tools that we have. Regarding what you were talking about, that we are pulled into our, like, almost, so a couple things came to my mind. It's like we have the book of Revelation. We trust God with the ending, but God doesn't tell us the story because that would spoil the story for us. You know, a great storyteller, what they have to do is they have to have a story that actually follows from logically from the facts. They have to have a set of facts and a set of details, and you can follow the story and it makes sense intuitively. There's no deus ex machinas. There's no sudden, oh, we have to pretend that didn't exist. And yet as the story unfolds, you're still continually surprised or blown away at particular moments, particular times. And obviously God's the best storyteller, and he gives us the revelation, but he allows the process of unfolding towards that revelation to be completely surprised. And Luke Thompson actually says, even God is surprised by how it moves. It's like God has faith in the process. Like maybe that's God the Father having faith in the Holy Spirit. Maybe that's the Son having faith in the Father. I don't know. Just trust, like you were saying. And then I think of Carl Jung, who believed, and Peterson too, that, well, Peterson talks about Jung believing this, but I think this is true, that the self, his conception of the self, is us, of who we're supposed to be in God's telos, pulling us into that final form, whatever that final form is. And the U-shaped journey or the struggle of our life is what we want, the orientation towards self, to go back to Chad, versus accepting our telos in God and letting the rest of it burn away. The threshing floor, and he will baptize with fire, and I think that's the constant struggle, to say give up everything and let your telos be done. I really think that's the purpose of our life. It's like whatever our role is in this great story, to ultimately and finally accept it. And that's actually the advice I would say to young men, is like, who do you want to be in the story? Like, who do you want to be? Do you want to be the whiny, the villain, the this, or do you actually want to be like an active, positive participant in the great story? And that's the gift and the choice that, as I see it, God gives us. And you would expect that the greatest storyteller would have an arena. All the world's a stage, right? But you would expect that the greatest storyteller would create an arena where all the evidence is stacked against you. 99.999% of species in history stacked against you. We see it all the time, that the rich prosper and the poor struggle, and da da da. And we are not born into equality. We have different talents, different skills, and da 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 da. And it seems like all creation is aligned against fairness, let's say. And the greatest storyteller will weave in a story and make all wrongs right. But you would expect the most impossible situation to be the stage for the greatest storyteller. That's the only way you get the greatest story, is you have to have the most impossible situation. So I don't know, like evolution and thinking about things in these terms has only increased my faith. And I know that's counterproductive, but it's like, of course the story is set up that way. Like every good story is an underdog story. Every single one, it's an underdog story. And that's it.
Yeah, I mean, you make a compelling case, you do. I mean, I felt very much that way myself, let's say 5 or 6 years ago. But just over time, as I've wrestled with this more and more, I more and more believe that however things happened up to the place of human beings, that human beings are different.
Yeah.
Different, and that that human beings are created just the way it says in the Bible. Now, I don't know how you get to that place, but that has become more and more what compels my thinking. So I've for a long time, I mean, from the time I started the channel, I was holding both of those ideas, one in each hand, and I could see how everything worked out in both of them. And I could certainly see the picture that you're drawing.
Can we talk about Genesis and the fall in relation to this paradigm?
Oh, you can
Because,
talk about wherever you want to. We have about
10
15 more
minutes?
minutes, so
Okay,
yeah.
okay.
Yeah.
So you there has to be something in Eve that makes her at least consider that the thing that she doesn't have is worth having. There has to be some, let's say, vulnerability, some lack in Eve, that she is missing something, whatever it is, even if that's an illusion. And I've heard Peugeot talk about this, where it was always God's intention to allow Adam and Eve to eventually, once they were ready, to reach and eat from that tree. But it's the kind of thing where they're reaching towards it's again that disembodiment. They're reaching towards the ideal before they're ready for it. And so the as I see it, the vulnerability of what they didn't have or what they were lacking was there first. And then there's a transgression. And I still don't know how to really think about that. But they're reaching for the thing beyond the physical good of where they are and should be. And then their vulnerability becomes fully conscious because then they hide. It becomes the dot. So that starts with desire, you could say. It starts with that instinct for the thing. But then the vulnerability becomes the driving force that they're governed by.
Well, I mean, I would step back one step and I would say there's something in Eve's lack of trust that God is good. Otherwise, there would have been no desire and no interest in that thing, because if she really believed that, if she trusted in the goodness of God, then she would believe that everything that she had was what she needed. And she didn't need anything else, because after all, God loves me. He's good. He would give me what I need. I trust him. And I mean, a lot of things come to mind. So in my mind, maybe the original sin is this lack of trust in God, because it's whenever we lose that trust and we think, oh well, I'm smarter, I'm wiser, I have a better idea, or the scientists have a better idea, or somebody has a better idea of how things should go than I do, or these political leaders, they've got the whole picture drawn out and they have a better idea of where how things should go than I do. And so you put your trust in someone else, or you put your trust in something else that is insufficient, because that's what the word idol, one of the words in the Old Testament that is translated as idol, is actually the word for insufficient. So you're putting your trust in something insufficient. So she put her trust in the serpent's words rather than putting her trust in God's words. And the serpent couldn't give her the whole answer because he doesn't know. He can deceive, but he's deceiving out of a lack of knowledge.
He can offer the thing now in the moment that appeals to that instinct, but God's not willing to reveal the entirety of the story because that would take away the gift of life. That would take away the gift of experience. Like, do you tell your child, okay, this is my favorite movie I've ever watched, and I'm going to tell you the whole thing before we watch it, or do you say to your child, well, trust me, like, you're really gonna like this, and maybe you're gonna be scared at certain parts, and maybe it's gonna, yeah, but
Well,
so
and so
yeah.
when you step back into that frame, that her first impulse needed to be that God is good and I will trust him. God's frame is out of his goodness. He has provided everything necessary, and he has a timetable. You can argue about what time means and everything, but in God's universe, for us, things lay out one thing after another. And if Jonathan is correct, and the tree was waiting there for us and would be there for us when we needed it, but we took it first because we believed that we knew things better than God did. But I'm chattering on now because I had a thought and I can't recollect it, and it had to do with the nature of God. Because you were saying that you made some statement about God's design. And
Revelation.
well, God writing the best story, there's always going to be the greatest challenges. Oh, free will. I think we have to consider how much God sacrificed in order to provide us with free will. Because our free will ultimately ended up costing him everything. And yet he's willing to go to those lengths in order to provide us with free will. So God must think that there is something eminently valuable in us having free will and making choices. And the first thing that we did with that free will was to deny that he was enough. Right? So, and kind of the way that I see it when I was talking about this upward call that everything adheres to, if you look at the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom and all living things and the cells and everything else, they're all always moving towards the ideal. Now, in the animal kingdom, that can look sometimes brutal, where some species are prey and some are predators, and the prey basically have to lay down their lives for the predator in order to feed the predator, and the predator takes in that life of the prey, and then the predator has other jobs, and they all have jobs within the kingdom to keep this ecology going, but they're all moving towards the ideal of what they are. It's only in the human realm that we don't move towards the ideal. That's one of the things that makes us different, is that we have free will and we say, no, I'm not going to go there because I got my own thing. I prefer my own thing, and I prefer not to believe that God's design is the best. So that's, to me, that's the thing that separates humanity out, is all the cells, all the mitochondria, everything is moving towards the ideal. And here we are like, nope, I'm not going to do that.
But at the same time, it's not like our conscience remains static across time. Like I notice, so I'll give you an example. Have you ever heard of the joke, The Aristocrats? It's probably a good thing that you haven't heard
You
of
mean
this
the
joke.
movie or?
Well, either the movie or just the joke, generally speaking. It's the
Maybe
dirtiest,
I've heard it, but
rottenest joke ever.
oh.
So it was a running joke between comedians that just within comedians they would tell each other this joke to try to get each other laugh. It's like a competition amongst comedians to tell the like dirtiest joke they can possibly imagine. And but then there was a documentary done about it. But there have been occasions where comedians have told the joke and to the public. And anyway, so I started playing this like 10 years ago. I would have laughed hysterically to play this, and I started playing this to a few people that I know pretty well now in Discord. And within like 5 seconds, I had shame and guilt, and I had to shut it off instantly. And there are other things that like my conscience is not the same that it was 10 years ago, like not even close. And I could say like, oh, maybe that's just arbitrary. There's no growth in Neil, like my instinct for good or morality or whatever. And I don't think that's true. I think there is growth. And so I also think there's growth in our quality detection, you could say. Like we don't have the same aesthetic preferences as an 8-year-old, as an 18-year-old, as a 30-year-old. We cultivate that sensibility. So it's not that the forms of beauty change per se, or the, sorry. It's not that the substance of beauty changes. It's that our capacity to be in relationship with that beauty changes, or that morality. And that's another thing I don't even want to try to unpack in 4 minutes. But the relationship between, let's say, morality and beauty. But
Well, but age isn't necessarily the dictator of that. I mean, I know you've read the C.S. Lewis quote where he talks about at every moment in time, as you age, you're either moving towards one or you're moving towards the other. So some people age in the wrong direction and become crabby and angry and resentful, and some people age in the other direction, become, loving and caring and more compassionate. And so age is no indicator of which direction you're going to go in that. it's the choices that we make with our free will at every juncture of life that are going to indicate whether we're moving closer to him or further away from him. So, yeah. But your main point when you were talking about that was.
Just I can see the evolution in myself. You can call it whatever you want, just change across time in myself, in these faculties, in instinct. So we talked about five senses, but I think we have much more than that, because I think guilt and shame are a sense. Conscience is a sense.
But right there, you did right there. You used the word evolution because that's kind of the way we've been trained in the last 150 to even 200, like 50 years before Darwin, that word was already being used. It's a word that describes a certain worldview, but we don't need to use that word. When you're talking about the changes that take place in you after you become a new creature, a new creation in God, why would we have to describe that as evolution? Those are
Be
changes that
because
are, it's more of a metamorphosis than it is an evolution.
you're
Because the
right. Well,
metamorphosis of a butterfly is quite a different thing than evolution.
or speciation of a different form. The reason I want to use the evolutionary lens is because the scientists, the atheist community, has used evolution as a blunt instrument against faith for 200 years. And quite frankly, I'm tired of it. But the second reason is because, and this is the most important thing I ever picked up from many of the new horsemen, or horsemen of new atheism, is from Dan Dennett. And he made the point that it has long been acknowledged that evolution will occur in any form, in any substrate that has replication, variation, replication, meaning a repeating game of some sort, variation, and differential fitness, meaning different outcomes have a better or worse, or sorry, different strategies have a better or worse outcome in that substrate. And so that's all I mean by evolution. I mean the process that unfolds when you have replication, when you have a repeating game taking place over any substrate. Could be corporations, could be human attention, could be religious bodies. But now, where I mean, our whole conversation has been where I disagree with scientists, because I believe that's all. Yeah, it's all unfolding to God ultimately. And I'm tired of it being just random all the way down. I don't think that's right. I don't think it's true. So yeah, no, I'm using their words, their tools, because I'm tired of being in retreat on that issue. So
Well, yeah, I mean, I can see why you're looking at it that way. I can also look at it from the standpoint of when you grant them the language, you've granted them the game, basically. So I think that you could make your arguments without using evolution as the word that you use to describe your argument and move towards more of the emanation of beauty because. Where I started thinking about this is a painting does not evolve. A painting changes from moment to moment as it's being woven together, but it's not evolving. The creator of the painting is actively involved in the life of the painting and in the final result of the painting. So in no way is it evolution. But it is a weaving together of the elements that are there, the substrate that is there, and the principles that govern the movement of these elements and how they're displayed on the substrate. So I just think evolution, unless you can find a way to if you want to make the argument that the creator is actively involved in every moment of evolution, and
Yeah.
evolution would be what would evolution be if it were a painting? That that once the strokes are set free on the canvas, they can move wherever they want to, and they're all doing their own thing. And then the artist's job is to, and I thought about it this way for a while, the artist's job is to put obstacles in certain places so that the free movement of the strokes, they get to the place where they need to be only by avoiding all these obstacles, and that ultimately the obstacles are guiding them towards the place that they need to be. Now, I thought about that a lot in terms of Jordan Peterson's chapter 4 in Maps of Meaning, when he wrote the chapter on anomaly. That really made me think about the power of anomaly to guide action. Because I think that is true in our lives. Part of the reason that we grow and develop as Christians is the anomalies that happen in our life that drive us to learn and to grow and to read and to pray, and that we gain wisdom through the anomalies that we face in life. So there may be some way in which organisms gain more information in their DNA through the obstacles that they confront as they move along, but then the obstacles becomes a gift. So every obstacle becomes a movement of the Lord saying, this is the obstacle that you need in order to become what you need to become at every point in the development of the organism.
Now,
That
I
makes
don't.
God even more involved
Yes, that's
with
exactly.
evolution.
I think none of it is arbitrary. So you asked the question, do I believe God's involved in everything? It's absolutely, absolutely. Like the way I would describe it is evolution is the process that sets the stage for the story. Now, obviously, physics also sets the stage, and this sets the stage, but in regard to life, so we have all these subdomains because it's a different way of describing the stage, whether it's chemistry, biology, physics. But there's a process
I
by
think the
which, yeah.
elements and the principles precede physics.
I agree. So when we never got to the unity, harmony, contrast, dominance, repetition, gradation, variation, and balance. I think those were set from the foundations of the world. Yeah. So I just wanted to ask you about those. So how were those eight derived? Was it a single person who said, these are the eight? Or was there some sort of,
No, I mean there are other people who have slightly different lists, but I mean they all boil down to basically the same idea. It was more a matter of observation over millennia of looking at that art which was considered beautiful, which was set aside in museums, which people came to look at, which people put their focus on. What are the common features of those works? And what is it that draws the eye? What is it that consumes people when they look at something and they think this is the ideal of beauty? What are the common factors in that piece that the artists were not even aware of when they were painting this work, but they were aware of beauty. They were seeking to represent beauty, and that there's something in us that's what beauty looks like to us, and that's what we create when we're considering beauty. So that impulse to beauty is already there. Now, it can be affected by what you see in your culture and how, so you'll see art in other cultures that will focus on different things. And yet, I'm pretty sure that if you looked at, say, the art from India or the art from the Islamic world or whatever, you would still find those same features there, but they might be in different proportions than they are in the Western canon of what is considered beautiful. But it was not designed by anybody. It was not invented by anybody. These principles and elements of design were sort of discovered over time as to this is what people consider beautiful. And of course, lumping into that is also the Fibonacci sequence, the golden mean, all of these mathematical relationships is also a part of that. And I would say also just the process of making art, whether you're painting a painting or writing a song or whatever, there are elements of that process that I would consider are also part of this thing that comes before everything. One of those things is limitation, limiting the frame so that you have some possibility of moving forward. So boundaries, edges, limitations are all very important. And the whole element of choice and the element of opponent processing, these are all things that are part of the process of the work. And then that also fits together with all these elements and principles of design and how they interact with each other.
Do you think all those elements and principles apply to four-dimensional forms of art? So what I mean by four-dimensional is through time. So music, story.
Oh yeah, and I don't know if you've ever listened to any of the episodes that I did with Drew's Ecology or with Dirt Poor Robins, Neil deGrade, and has a channel called Mystery. I can't think of his name right now, but he's another musician that I had on, and I have had like four different musicians on, and we've talked our way through this, looking at how works of music are produced. And of course, I had the long discussion with Richard Watson, who came up with this theory of evolution that doesn't require natural selection, but his theory is based on music, that music is actually the way that life arose, using resonances and harmonies and so forth. And he's a well-known researcher. I'm going to share a screen here very quickly with something.
Sure.
See if I can find this. No, that's not the right thing. Let's see. No, I'm typing too fast. My left hand doesn't work very well. I'm trying to get to this company called Metagora. Here it is. Okay, can you see the screen?
Yep.
It's a little hard because the contrast is not very strong, but can you see all these nodes and
All the
edges
clustering.
moving? Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, now this happens to be interactive, so let's take my cursor, and let's say that my cursor is my paintbrush, and I'm going to move my paintbrush. Now I have, you see how everything interacts with the paintbrush? You can see that, right?
But the
Almost
so the
like
connection strengthens the closer the
spider webs
entities.
or something.
Yeah,
It's
yep.
creating new shapes So I was trying to come up with saw an app that would be like this, where I could say, okay, there's two nodes there, one on either side of my cursor, and maybe that's a binary of dark and light. Now, if I move towards the dark end of that, that's going to change all the other choices that are associated with that choice. If I move towards the right end of that's going to make another whole set of choices available to me. So every time I make a choice, maybe I'm going to go towards the blue instead of the orange. That's going to change my, and maybe I move over here on the painting to something entirely different. And that's setting up a whole bunch of new relationships. So every time the brush moves, it's changing all these relationships. And I think that's the way, Rovelli and other guys in the physics community talk about this idea that everything is relational, that relationality is what's at the base of the universe. Now, not everybody agrees with them, but I think that's a very interesting idea, that without relationality, the universe wouldn't exist. So,
That's how I see the Holy Spirit in a nutshell. I mean, it's the glue
relation,
that,
yes.
yeah, it's the glue that holds everything together in love.
Yeah. So, yep, that's Now, somebody told me that I could somehow get the code of that thing and recreate it so that I'd have a page I could work with like that. But I don't know how to do that. Some coder's got to figure that out. I even asked Claude, and Claude gave me a whole page of, well, if you do this and this and this, you'll be able to get that code. But I mean, I don't know how to do the things it told me to do. So anyway, I think it would be very fun to have an app that would do that, where you could explore.
What you could do is send an email to 10 of the most tech savvy, I'm not one of them, but 10 of the most tech savvy folks that you've ever talked to, just BCC, so they're not replying to each other, and just say, hey, can anyone, can you help me with this? And then whoever responds first, you can just reply to the other saying, hey, I got it. Thank you.
Yeah, I know, but I really do try to respect people's time and effort, because everybody I know is working on very important things, and I don't want to disrupt their time and attention for some random thing, you know.
But at the same time, they have an opportunity to reciprocate, provide a gift for the service that you've been giving to many. So I think it's
Well,
okay to give
if
permission.
anybody's still listening at this point, and there's somebody in there that wants to tackle this for me, just let me know. I'll gladly receive the help. This has been great, Neil, and I'm sure you've given people a lot to think about.
Hope so.
Yeah,
Thank you.
I still don't know whether the social imaginary evolution necessitates evolution from the ground up as being part of the background of that, because even microevolution would produce the same kind of effects. So, yeah. Have a wonderful holiday, and
Thank
maybe
you.
we
Merry
can get
Christmas.
together sometime in January.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
Okay.
Thanks, Karen. Thanks for
Bye-bye.
having me on. Bye-bye.
Gotcha.